You open up your bag of specialty coffee. You weigh, grind, and the aroma blows your mind. Your brew goes perfectly, but uh-oh. What went wrong? Your water, that's what. Third Wave Water helps give that cafe-quality experience at home, unlocking all the bright flavors your coffee has to offer. Just add one stick of minerals to a gallon of distilled water to upgrade your coffee experience. Visit thirdwavewater.com and use coupon code COFFEEPODCAST for 10% off your first order. You're listening to the Coffee Podcast. I'm Jesse Hartman. Before we jump into this episode, I want to make two announcements. Firstly, we have over 10 episodes in the pipeline ready for some ad partners. These days, the cast is dependent on advertising because I have to pay contractors to help me research, produce, and publish. This is the result of a full-time job that is not the podcast, and I am signed up for what some might consider to be too many things. Secondly, I have another baby girl on the way, so while I love the podcast, my wife will kill me if I try to personally fund this project. Right, hun? Okay, enough. Please, please, please reach out about sponsorships because I don't want our listeners to have to listen to underwear commercials and more content. In this episode, we talk again with Carl Weinhold, author of Cheap Coffee, but this time focused on some other research he did that tries to tackle some of the questions he had after authoring the book. So we're going to jump into this paper, The Embedded Agroecology of Coffee Agroforestry. So hopefully I've said all those words correctly. What inspired this paper and what was your participation and the participation of the other authors?
Sorry about the title. I know it's a mouthful, but I guess such is academic literature. Some of those terms are like indicative of the theoretical approach and it's a whole thing. But yeah, so this is an interesting one. It's not, I'm doing a PhD now, so I'm spending my time doing research, basically trying to answer the questions that I couldn't in Cheap Coffee.
Okay.
But, and this is not part of it. It was kind of a random thing, just a connection came up on a trip, and then I found myself trying to figure out a question of what are the barriers to agroforestry in coffee in Uganda and Malawi? So, like, why are people not doing it, and how do we get them to do it? And I just thought about this question for a while, and I'm thinking, how do we know anyone even wants agroforestry? So I started kind of going about it in that direction, and you know, that project went okay. I was able to do a little desk research there, and then decided to put together this paper based on it. And about this perspective of like the rural development planners, like I once was, that determine what is a best practice. So like based on whatever science we have, we think that coffee farmers should be planting trees in their coffee plots because it's going to be great because of the environment, because of carbon, because of whatever. And then we send some technicians to share these practices and then farmers have to do them. But what happens often is that farmers don't really accept this information the way that the planners and the technicians that I used to be thought they would, and sometimes it doesn't get implemented, and then you know we sit around and complain amongst each other that farmers are so stubborn and so short-term and you just aren't ready and need more education, and you bring out the education programs and you know it's a whole mess. But you know, after kind of leaving that world and going in as more of a community organizer and getting to know how people operate a little bit better, I realized that it's not as simple as that. That this idea of embeddedness, which is like an old time political economy, sociological political economy, if that's a thing, Carlo Polanyi, in like the 1940s, wrote about this. It's that this economic actors are embedded in their social world. Their decisions are more complex than just how do I profit, and especially with agriculture. In isolated areas, it's intertwined with family life, with cultural heritage, with their spirituality. So like some technician comes and says, you and your grandparents and your great-grandparents have been doing this thing all wrong because I said so, because look at the spreadsheet. So you're going to change, right? No, probably not, because this is a very, this is much more complex than just, okay, I put in trees, maybe I make a little bit more money, or these guys pay me to put these trees. Okay, finished. And this has everything to do with like different epistemologies, the way that people know and learn thing, that this idea of cause and effect, like I plant these trees, this will happen. This is what this guy says will happen. based on what I think because of the collective social memory of my community, I may not buy that cause and effect theory of what, you know, this spreadsheet says.
Hmm.
So really wanted to explore this. And you know, I think anything critical in that paper and in the book and whatever I do is usually trying to really criticize a former version of myself. Because as I said, I've made all of these errors many times before.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned collective social memory, I think is what you said. What is that?
Yeah, so like whatever you know, whatever is your common sense. Whatever common sense is for you is not what it is for someone else, because, you know, where does that come from? Not because you read it and took a note and memorized it and got an A on a test. It's just common sense. It's just what people know. It has to do with your values, what's important about, you know, what a good outcome looks like, about what kind of activities are pleasant and off-putting. And if you do this, this other thing would happen. That's why you shouldn't go swimming after eating or you know, whatever. I think this is kind of like the autopilot in how we live our lives. That's not as deliberate as like what we can find evidence and implement. And everyone already has that. So if you come in with a different one and this theory based on a spreadsheet, they're not going to change. It'd be like, all right, what are the barriers to people wearing their socks on their hands in Maryland? Well, nobody wanted to do that anyway. So what do you mean, what are the barriers? So why would anyone want to do that in the first place?
Yeah. Like, I could see that attached to, like, some argument. Like, your hands will never wrinkle if you wear socks on your hands for, you know. And people being like, it's just not going to happen.
And I mean, okay. If you hired the right celebrities and hammered into people's heads for long enough, maybe a few people would start. And then it'd be hard to get them to stop, because it's part of the collective social memory at that point.
Okay. So when we're talking about agroforestry, we're talking about plant intercropping. Is that like a subtopic, or is that like a main part of agroforestry? So like planting coffee trees with other kinds of crop?
Yeah, that's one form of agroforestry.
Okay. It's typically accepted that agroforestry is better than that, you know, full sun, you know, just plant everything. Monocropping, I guess, is the monocropping.
Yeah.
And so showing up to some farmer's monocropped coffee farm and saying, hey, you really need to pull up some of your coffee trees. You need to plant some of these, I don't know, banana trees or whatever, is basically like a very crude explanation of what we're kind of talking about.
That's not crude. I've done exactly that dozens of times.
So, but that's the like kind of the main topic of this paper, right? Is that process of engaging with a farmer?
Yeah, basically, like how people would interpret that information based on their own way of knowing and learning, how they see the benefits, the trade-offs, what doing it implies, what that sacrifice is for them, which may not be the same for someone outside of it looking at it. What's wrong to begin with that needs to be fixed also a matter of how you see things.
Yeah, I've wondered about this before, where we have these really large coffee companies that maybe they're funding some research, and that research might, I don't know, maybe the research discovers, hey, we really need to plant this. And then they decide, well, okay, we'll go to the farmer and say, you know, you need to do X, Y, Z. And the farmer either does it or doesn't do it, or does some in between. That process in the name of sustainability from the big coffee companies being like, hey, we have to ensure our future, is a very different story than that coffee farmer at their family farm for the fifth generation doing the thing that they've been doing.
Yeah. And it's part of family life. It's the daily routine, you know, how you divide your day up, how the family integrates into the operation, and saying like, you know what? A tractor could do that better and faster, so go.
Hmm.
That doesn't really work.
Yeah, yeah. Also, is it, maybe you know this, is it typically, does the cost of doing all this work fall on the farmer too? Or is there like typically like subsidized, I don't know, what's the word I'm thinking of? When you redo your farm?
Yeah, renovation. A lot of times there's help. A lot of times when we're talking about varieties, like the seedlings will be free. But then, I mean, maybe so you get these seedlings so you can plant a monocrop system, you can put in twice as many coffee trees as you had before, you can have twice as much output, we'll give you the seedlings for free, but now it's going to need three times more fertilizer as before, it's going to need twice as much picking labor as before, and you're on the hook for that. And then, you know, once production is double, the price drops, so then you sell it for a lot less, and well, the seedling was free though.
Okay.
Maybe the seedling's one manifestation.
And then the next, or, you know, after the 3 years it takes for the coffee plant to finally fruit, right? Because that's time. Isn't it roughly 3 years for that first fruit?
Yeah, I think you get a little bit in two, but yeah, it's 3 or 4.
Okay.
To get, you know, the good production.
Okay, so year two or three, and then somebody else comes along and says, hey, no, you should be participating in agroforestry. You need to rip up some of these.
Yeah.
That would be, man, so frustrating.
Yeah, and that's what's hard, because like what I found in the research for the paper is a lot of folks never made that initial switch, at least in Colombia, where, well, I did the research was in Malawi, Uganda, and Colombia, and in Colombia is where I did it myself on the ground.
Oh, okay.
And I found a lot of the places where that initial like green revolution monocrop, you know, chemical intensive agriculture never really took hold, in a lot of cases because of armed conflict and, you know, different reasons why these areas were more isolated than others. It was a lot easier to do like a more intentional version of agroforestry later on, because people were still used to doing it that way, still valued that part of the, you know, the custom. But in other areas where for the last 20-30 years all of the agronomists with the nice boots and the collared shirts that come to sell you the fertilizer have been saying that no, this is the way it's done, this is the way you make more money, this is, you know, you've got to have a high production. And this has also just been really drilled into people's heads for a long time, and now just going and reversing that, it doesn't come easy, because I guess for a lot of reasons, but for example, there's all this kind of bad, you know, information going around because people want to sell you something, so they tell you this is how agriculture works. So then somebody else that maybe are looking out for a farmer's productive resilience or cost of production or something comes out with, looks kind of the same colored shirt, the same nice boots.
Yeah.
And said, now I've got the new best thing for you. Of course, they're going to be skeptical.
I mean, we're talking about all this stuff in the scope of agriculture, coffee, but really this is just relationship stuff, right? Like if you're in a bad relationship with somebody, your next relationship is harder because it's harder to build trust because the last relationship was bad. So it's kind of what's happening, right? You have these coffee producers who are trying to do their best to not just make money, but provide for their families and to pay the pickers well, etc. And then you get all this mix matchy information about how you should be growing, what's the best way forward. So interesting stuff.
Yeah, this is basically adding the you know, making economics into a social science is how I like to put it, that because, you know, economics is about people, and people are complex, infinitely complex, especially when they live together in societies and have, you know, values and customs and everything. So we can't take that for granted just because someone is materially poor and someone else is less so and has some solution for them.
What were some of the big takeaways for you personally? I mean, you had boots on the ground in Colombia, so maybe that was different than the other locations that the research was part of. What were your main takeaways?
Yeah, well, basically, I had just really set out to demonstrate kind of the dimensions of this complexity, and I think that was possible. I guess to understand the complexity of how people solve problems, like how people qualify what information is valid, and kind of the way people access information, that I asked a lot of people that question, that what are the believable and unbelievable or credible sources of information about farming practices? And everybody said their family and their neighbors. And this is in places where, this is in Colombia, where there are armies of technicians and agronomists funded by international aid organizations, by NGOs, by, you know, a lot of the big coffee companies are out there doing their corporate social responsibility to teach farmers how to farm. And no one mentioned any of them. as the more credible sources. Some of them mentioned the SENA, the public education service, but everybody mentioned it's from my family and my friends, because I mean, no one trusts what someone who doesn't farm says how you should be farming, which makes perfect sense.
Interesting. Yeah, makes total sense. I guess all the more important, what is that, marketing? Oh, now I've got to be careful. I feel like you have a degree in marketing, don't you? I'm going to say a thing.
No.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Feel free.
Yeah, there's this idea where, you know, the best salesperson is a customer that sells your product for you, right? So if you have a customer that loves what you do, then it'll sell itself, because that customer will become a spokesperson for your brand, whatever. That's kind of the idea. But with ideas or concepts like how you should be growing coffee, then it would make sense in this context that you would want to target a few key players who want to learn about agroforestry, and then they would tell their neighbors, and that would be like the way that this could maybe take off. I don't know. I'm just thinking.
Yeah. I mean, that would have answered the initial question that I was presented with. That was like, how do we convince people to do this? But I think what I've tried to conclude here is that you shouldn't be convincing people to do anything. You should start with what people want to do. What are their goals and objectives? What are their values?
Yeah.
And then like, what implicit theories are of cause and effect are they using to guide their behavior? And you know, how can any outsider that wants to be there, if the farmers want them there, how can they be helpful to reach those goals, not to influence how they're doing things? I mean, education is a tricky one. This is another one I see on like ESG reports a lot, and you know, this is tough because sharing information is one thing. Maybe there's information that people want and could use, but another thing is influence, that you know, what you should be doing, how you should be doing it, which is a really different sort of education.
Yeah, sort of a best practices education. Like if somebody, I don't know, if I was like mowing my yard, which is not the same thing at all as farming, but if I was mowing my yard, my neighbor came over, or no, not my neighbor, some salesperson selling lawnmowers came over and said, hey, you're doing it wrong. You should do it this way.
Like, you should be doing it this way if what?
Yeah.
And then do you agree on what? And this okay. is, I think this is the thing that's not sorted out in a lot of these cases, because a lot of times outsiders just have this implicit assumption that the only thing that you know, I hear this thing often that like, we have to teach farmers that their farm is a business, that they are entrepreneurs. But I think that is wrong in a lot of ways, because a subsistence coffee farm is not just a business. I mean, it's a source of sustenance, but it's also a source of lifestyle. All of life happens at the farm, and not all of life is economic. You can't assign a value to it. So any kind of recommendation that will help you, make it more profitable or more productive or generate more income is probably not going to be unwelcome. But the terms and what has to be done and changed in order to achieve that may not be acceptable or desirable at all.
Yeah. I mean, in this case, promoting agroforestry, it's not really low-hanging fruit unless you're already there. Like you mentioned before, if somebody's already adopted monocrop situation, it's just not going to be straightforward to be like, yeah, you just need to switch.
Yeah, I think it's the matter of like where this is coming from. Like if farmers have this interest and they're vulnerable to drought and they're spending a lot on fertilizer and they're looking for a solution, they're looking for a better way to farm so that they won't have to spend so much on fertilizer, they'll be less vulnerable to droughts and floods and whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe agroforestry would be something that would meet their needs. But I think all of these kind of things, we can't start with the practice because someone like me looking at spreadsheets all day said it was the best. And then, all right, now we're going to convince you it's the best. All of these kind of things have to come from a genuine need of the people that would be doing it.
Yeah, I guess that the challenge is sometimes by the time you realize there's a need, like I'm trying to think as a farmer, maybe by the time maybe that I realize, for example, a few of my plants have leaf rust is an example maybe I'll use. By the time I realize that, is that too late? You know, so there's this like preventative also nature of trying to help people
yeah.
who may not see what's coming. Oh, that's some complex stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Like the folks I was working with on this, I should mention them. What is it? The Slow Food Coffee Coalition. Slow Food is this nonprofit from Italy, and they do a lot of work in these places. And the initial project used a lot of their data, and they're involved in this. And basically was just like, so they have resources, I don't know from where. Yeah, but they interface with these cooperatives in Uganda, and they say, now what do you guys want to do? What do you want to learn? So, and they said, well, we want to know about agroforestry because we have these problems. We think it could be helpful. And they say, okay, we'll share information about that.
Cool.
And then people can do that if they want to, but they're not gauging the success based on how many people actually do it, like is normally the best practice. People can have this information. They can use it however they want to, or they cannot use it.
Very cool. Well, I think we're coming down to the end of our interview here. I have some typical last few questions that I ask, so I'm going to ask those to you. And the final question will be kind of a choose your own story. So the first question is, what are you currently working on, and how can our listeners be a part of that?
Yeah, so I mentioned I'm doing a PhD now. I'm working on a thesis, which is, you know, basically what was kind of left out of the book, if you will. So what my thesis is about, the sources, manifestations, and outcomes of power in the coffee value chain. And that looks at some different dimensions. I'm focusing on the quantitative side, looking at the C price and how that kind of affects the income of individuals around the world. Another part will be about specialty coffee, like whether that represents an actual opportunity for farmers to change the situation, whether, you know, the power structure and distribution of income is fundamentally different there. And the last part will be about the institutions. What are the rules, written and unwritten, of this game, and kind of where are the corners of the coffee world that work a little bit better and worse for farmers, to see if there may be some keys to, you know, how farmers could guide their activities to reach their own goals, whatever those might be. So looking at kind of the structural and historical issues that, you know, I think we have these conversations a lot that, oh, it's the fair trade, well, it's organic, well, it's the C price, well, it's the multinationals and whatever, and then we can't really put our finger on what's really going on here. And I think a lot of these conversations end in this conclusion that, oh, well, it's structural, well, it's been going on for a long time since colonialism, but I've never really heard what people mean exactly by that. So I'm trying to figure out what exactly are these structural issues, how do they come to be, you know, how do they affect what's going on?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the conversations with coffee price always end with, well, it's just a complex problem. And it's well, that leaves me nowhere to go.
So precisely. I've had that conversation so many times, and I don't have an answer, but I think we could really use one.
It must be a really hard problem because there's a lot of very smart people trying. And so sounds cool. Your work sounds neat. Is that going to end up being a book, or that's your thesis? I guess it's not a book.
Yeah. So and hopefully there'll be 3 scientific papers, and then I don't know. We'll see what happens. Hopefully it'll be possible.
Wow. Sounds like a lot of work.
But if I may, you mentioned how listeners could be a part of this. And this is actually super relevant because in order to do that, the thing I need is data at all points along the value chain from beginning to end all around the world. What we really need to know to be able to paint a picture is a massive amount of diverse data to find out, you know, how the trade is really working. So in the next couple of months, I'm going to be trying to reach out to some folks, and we'd love to hear from anyone who's interested in contributing to these kind of things to see, especially on like the analysis of specialty price pass through. That, like, so farmers, if they're making coffee that is graded at such a level, they're selling it for such price, then it's ending up in consumer markets at another price. Is that actually better for them? So basically what's on these like price transparency reports, I'm just trying to aggregate tons and tons of that kind of data to try to see if there are any patterns or interesting places that farmers can try to get to.
Very cool. Yeah. Anybody listening? Yeah. We'll have an email for Carl listed on the episode notes. So be sure to reach out to him there. And Carl, last question, choose your own adventure here. Either what is the best piece of advice you've ever received, or what do you want the listeners to take away from these two conversations that we just had? if they only remember one thing, you can tell I like to ask this question because it kind of gets down to the heart, the meat of what we want to remember and know.
Yeah, let's see. I think I could answer them both with the same statement. Maybe the advice that was passed to me is the same I would leave other folks with.
Nice.
It was Daniel Giovannucci. He does a lot of research. I don't know how I'd describe him exactly. But he reached out to me when I was beginning the book process, just like a random email to the contact form, and told me something along the lines of that these trading mechanisms and structures haven't really been around for all that long, and there's no reason that they can't change. These aren't set in stone. This isn't like the law of the land. It's just what we have now. It's the best thing we have because it's what's going on right now. So I think this is what I'd also pass on, that we can't justify the way things work. This is just how it is. Sorry, it's supply and demand. I don't think we need to accept any of these kind of explanations. They need to be at least questioned, if not thrown out altogether, because we live in a paradigm of made up rules and structures that we use to try to help us make sense of it and navigate it, but none of them are real, and they can change if we want them to.
Hmm. Wow, that's cool. I'm going to be thinking about that the rest of the day.
Yeah. Welcome to my world.
Nice. Well, that's all we have for this episode. If you're listening on Spotify, tell us what you learned by clicking through to the episode and leaving a comment. I will highlight some responses for all Spotify listeners to see. Links to resources can be found in the episode notes. Stay tuned for the next episode, where we get to talk about art and coffee. And no, I don't mean latte art. I tried that once, and if you know how that went, you know how that went. I want to thank Ryan Ingerson for his fantastic research for this episode and episodes to come as well. Cheers, friend. For now, as always, and until next time, happy brewing.